Hey, good day, and welcome to another great episode of the OIG Roundtable. I always smile because I always get confused. Is it the OIG Files? Is it the OIG Roundtable? And then I realize that when it's all of us together, where it's the Brady Bunch table is really what it should be. So
here's the story of a lovely lady who was bringing up three very lovely girls. All of them had hair of gold.
Well, good day again. Welcome to another great episode. I am joined again by Wade McFowell, retired assistant special agent in charge at the LA field office, now a member of our SIU investigative team. Jason Eisengein, retired member of the senior leadership of the OIG's Office of Investigations, and then most recently retired as the Western UPIC director. And then Matt Kachansky, also a member of retired member of the OIG's senior leadership and the now also retired Northeast UPIC director. And I still am Eric Rubenstein. I am the senior director of litigation, fraud, waste, and abuse here at Advise. Thanks again for joining us for this episode. Today, we're going to talk about what's known in the UPIC world, Unified Program Integrity Contractor world, as the MCC, or the Major Case Coordination. In late 2018, November of 2018, CMS, Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and more directly, what is known as CPI, the Center for Program Integrity, launched this initiative that was going to be bringing the UPICs, the MEDIC, which is the Part C and D UPIC, for lack of a better term, OIG, DOJ, and CMS together on a routine cadence to review what are considered to be larger cases. So, Matt, I'm going to start with you. So 2018, the then director over at CPI, Alec Alexander, came out and announced that there was this brand new initiative that was going to take place, and it was going to be kicked off probably starting in early 2019 with that announcement at the end of 2018. The MCC was put into the Program Integrity Manual. You can find information about the about the MCC within Chapter 4 of the Program Integrity Manual about what the MCC is. But give people that are tuning in, what is the MCC and what was its original purpose?
Mm-hmm. Sure. A little background. The CMS OIG and the CMS contractors have been in a pendulum-like relationship for decades. With CMS, swinging back and forth whether how close the relationship should be between the UPICs and the OIG, and in 2018, Alec Alexander looked at that relationship and said there needs to be more of direct conversations between the stakeholders, the OIG, the CMS admin action specialists, and the UPICs to discuss cases, because there had been a dearth of referrals to the OIG in recent years. The prior policy was first on the base, you keep the case. If it was a UPIC case, do all the administrative actions and then refer to the OIG and see if they want it. And that just didn't generate any positive referrals. So Alec wanted to change that and have discussions during the course of the investigations to see whether or not the OIG would want them or not, or to see if they were more ready to do administrative actions. So the MCC is a way of getting all the stakeholders together in one room, the OIG, DOJ, sometimes when you're dealing with Medicaid cases, the state prosecutors, the MFUKUs, as well as the suspension team and the revocation team from CMS. And what the UPICs were asked to do, at least initially, it was going to be for three rounds of this and then go out on your own and continue the relationships. But it became a permanent fixture of the CPI, was to have monthly MCC meetings where each of the UPICs would make their presentations to their respective OIG regions, main justice, civil and criminal, and then the CMS folks, where we presented what we believed are best cases that met the criteria for presentation would be presented, and then decisions would be made during the meeting as to the best way to resolve those cases. OIG would say, yes, send the referral to us. if not that, then the revocation team would say, yes, send it to us or work it up for revocation and send us the revocation paperwork, or the suspension team. And or the other one was go back and investigate it more. UPIC's goal was to get as many as they could to get, you know, to get the action and not have any come back, you know, to have more investigation, because that was seen as a failure for us. And so, you know, we would present our, you know, dozen or so cases every month and let the stakeholders make their decisions.
So what's the criteria? So you're not bringing every case, right? I mean, you know, so you and Jason were in two of the larger UPIC regions, right? So there's Northeast UPIC, Southeast UPIC. So Northeast UPIC has Maine to DC, right? Virginia, yep. That area. And then Southeast UPIC is from that border down. And then you've got the Midwest UPIC, which has a small swath in the Midwest. You got the Southwest UPIC, which has Texas and a bunch of states. And then, you know, Jason's over in the Western UPIC, which has, what, 11 or 14 states. So you and Jason were in two of the larger UPICs, but certainly not just maybe geographically, but population density, right? Jason's got the, you know, a very dense part of the West. You're in the Northeast, you know, hugely. You can't present every case to the MCC. You've got an inventory of hundreds of cases, right? Average investigator caseload is probably 20, 30, 50 cases maybe in different states. You know, those numbers are really unbelievable when people hear them, but what's the criteria that, you know, CMS would want to have for an MCC?
It was to present the cases at the earliest possible time where they met the criteria for CMS to take a suspension action, a revocation action, or where the evidence that we've collected through whatever means, interviews, medical review, would be of interest to the OIG that there's a probable cause, not probable cause, but at least evidence of credible evidence that fraud had been committed, so that the OIG would be interested in those things. Right. And so it was, you know, it was our strongest cases at that time. The earliest possible time, you know, get it in there as fast as possible, kind of handcuff the UPICs a little bit, because we didn't, you know, we wanted to get the cases in there quickly, because we'd be, you know, criticized as, like, why wasn't this presented last month when you had this evidence? So, you know, kind of some of these cases were very immature when they were presented, but it was with the evidence, the bare evidence that was needed to make that criteria of interest of the OIG and the CMS ingrained criteria for suspensions and revocations.
So essentially the criteria was clear as mud, as far as what the top of the, you know, cases, there weren't any threshold or that. So Jason, I want to take that and I want to bring it over to you, right? Because now you're on the other side of the country in a UPIC that is equally inundated with cases and the like. What did you see as some of the challenges when you are being put in front of the MCC kind of committee and panel? And just to give people a flavor, the MCCs were held in a kind of war room at CMS's headquarters in Woodlawn, Maryland. And it's essentially, you know, I would go there, and it, to me, it was always like when you're going to NASA or you're watching the launch of something, there's multiple rows of kind of low-walled cubicles where everybody has a computer monitor and everybody plugs their laptop in, and there's maybe 40 or 50 people that are sitting at this like DEFCON 3 situation, and everybody is feverishly typing away, clicking and doing things, and you can't what are they clicking at? What are they typing? What is all of this fever stuff? But, you know, so that's the landscape, right? It's like, you know, we would say in the NYPD world, the NYPD Blue World, it would be CompStat, right? It's you're going in there and you're presenting your findings and you're talking this, and then you're getting beaten up about why you didn't get this or didn't get that. So Jay, you know, you're sometimes doing these remotely, sometimes you're going there. I'm not sure if it's worse to get a beating over Zoom or if it's worse to get a beating in person, but what are some of the challenges that you found in selecting the cases that you were going to have to present on behalf of the Western UPIC?
So I would say that you want to keep in mind that all fraud is local, even in Medicare. Okay, obviously Medicaid is a state-administered program. Medicare is a national program. But nonetheless, there are somewhere around, 90 federal judicial districts, each with an FBI office in those judicial districts. OIG certainly at one time had presence in an office in every state, and that reduced over time, but nonetheless, it's obviously has a national footprint and responsibility for addressing fraud and abuse in Medicare and Medicaid nationally. So, but having said that, yeah, in Southern California, where, there just are more hospices than, anyone would ever need. And, but then you also have the responsibility of having to assess situations in less populous states, whether it be Montana or Wyoming or, North Dakota. And, it's hard to compare even in Medicare, a national program, the fraud that might be occurring in a less populous state with a state like California. And so, but yet the judicial districts there are, equally responsible for mitigating fraud and abuse in healthcare in their respective jurisdictions. So, you'd have to work it up so that it was clear that even if the dollar amount didn't, rise to the level of, let's say, Southern California, it was still important in the context in which it was occurring. And so that concept was somewhat difficult to deploy and maintain. But one other thing I want to add, and you said it, Eric, I think it was 1999 was the first time the SAC of the New York office sent the ASACs, of which I was one, to CompStat meetings at NYPD. And I thought, oh my gosh, what a grueling process that is. And yeah, the MCC could be a grueling process, but the reality is that I do want to say that I feel that the taxpayers benefited from that insertion, that process insertion. I think, in fact, there was a catchphrase that Alec came up with at the time, and I'm not doing it justice, but the right tool for the right situation at the right time. And that's truly it, because in previous days, and to your point, Eric, about why do cases take so long, it's not to suggest that they're no longer taking a long time, but that maybe taking less time, or at least one cases that need to be served more immediately are being benefited by that, because at least with those stakeholders in the room, it wasn't like, oh, well, let's send this over for an admin action. And then it didn't rise to some technical level for that. And then back to another department and another group of people. And it would take months for it to cycle through that group, where whether in person or virtually in the same room, mitigated that time to some extent.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot to digest, because the MCCs are here to stay, right? I mean, they're an integral part of what the UPIC's roles are. And I think that there's a place for it. So I want to go to you, because one of the things that the MCC actually does, which I think can be brought in to individual SIUs, right? So one of the things that we do here at Advise is we do a lot of these SIU process improvement reviews, right? Come in and kind of look under the hood. What's working, what's not working, where do we think some efficiencies can be derived? A lot of that comes down to training and education. And I've said this before, we've done some training where we go out and we have 20 SIU investigators in a room, and you ask a question about something and you get 20 investigators giving you 30 different responses to how they do something. So there's no consistency across the board, where there should be. But, one of the things that the MCC, I think, theory can bring, or the premise of the theory of what it is this within an SIU, the collaboration, right? So, you're doing a lot of work on the SIU side now, And as a manager at the OIG, you would kind of see what all of the cases were that your squad was working on. And so, you know, one of the things that comes to mind for me from a process improvement perspective is that an MCC type scenario within an SIU creates that collaborative effect, which helps to move cases quickly. So I just want to turn over to you to talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, the MCC was not operational when I was in ASAC. It happened after I retired, but I did see it from kind of a couple different angles because I was with the medic at the time. I was with Health Integrity, later Clarent. So I participated in MCC meetings and in presenting cases, but also kind of observing the whole process and realizing how much it was an important kind of aspect to move the cases along. So I would look at, I would attend the meetings when I was presenting, and then I would kind of look at them from, you know, the way it worked was maybe, first of all, they're several hours long. They were pretty intense. It might be a 3-hour meeting. So it would be like, okay, the Southern California ASACs are going to start, and they would basically have one or two agents present stuff, and then it would go to another region. Maybe Dallas would have, you know, 45 minutes or so, and then it would go to New York. And one of the kind of logistical problems I kind of saw with that is I think a lot of people sat through presentations that didn't really have anything to do with them. The whole process was very important, but the ASACs in Los Angeles and the agents who were presenting didn't necessarily have to sit through Dallas or Chicago's presentations. And I think there was an attempt to, they scheduled it kind of, you know, the first hour will be this team and the second hour will be this team. But a lot of times there was logistical issues where they're like, okay, is LA ready? Well, we have an agent stuck in traffic, so let's go to, you know, another region and come back. So there was some logistical problems. Overall, it was a very important thing, especially for the ASACs to kind of see what was going on. I think the agents may have had more of a take on it, like it's, you know, they don't need to sit through that. They pretty much wanted the Z-picks, the U-picks, whoever to kind of hands off once they got the case. If they had something for them, more information, they were all about it. But a lot of times they didn't really want to have the back and forth. But anyways, going back to the SIU part, I think it's easier to do this on a much smaller scale when you're not talking about a footprint of the whole country. If you have an SIU that has 10 or 15 or even 30, you know, investigators, I think it's definitely an important part, an important tool in your toolbox. The SIU that I've been working with, we haven't really done it that much, but I think it's mainly because there's been a lot of turnover, hence the reason for a lot of advised people working there. So it's been kind of a turbulent kind of atmosphere, and it really hasn't been happening. But surprisingly, this week we had, it wasn't strictly an MCC, but it was a like an all hands meeting. We discussed different things, and I think it's kind of morphing into where it is going to be more like an MCC. Everybody talked about we should be doing this more on a monthly basis. So I think, we haven't really been doing that, I think as of this week in the meeting and everybody thought it was very beneficial, I think we're going to be doing more of that.
Yeah, I know, you know, we're in the process here at Advise, we're in the process of doing a process improvement and kind of a look under the hood, 360-degree review for a plan that's got about 2 million members over a number of states. And so, you know, kind of getting back to what Jason said is that all fraud is local, and that's true. And, you know, one of the things that you can go back and you can look at is when the original Strikeforce was created in, I think, 2017, and they did it in Miami, they then tried to export the exact model out to Brooklyn, which was the second Strikeforce city that came about. Well, the problem was that the fraud that was being perpetuated down in Miami was not exportable to that model, just didn't work. And in the Miami Strikeforce, they were identifying instances in which claims were going out for, you know, providers whose mailing addresses were dirt lots, right? There was just nothing there. It was a very, very straightforward fraud. Whereas in Brooklyn, we were shocked to find it was actual fraud being perpetuated in buildings and things of that sort. So that locality is an important piece. And what we've been suggesting to our SIU process improvement clients that we're doing work on is some version of the MCC. And I guess it didn't really hit me until the other day that we've been talking about doing an MCC with them, but just not calling it the MCC. But it's essentially the same thing. And I think what you're, you know, to your point, Wade, is when you've got the ability to have those meetings internally, you can discuss what may be a case I've got where there's a similar code, a similar scheme, it's a similar something that may be in a position to help you kind of spearhead getting that investigation going, which kind of gets back to the whole discussion that we always have is why do cases take so long because of all these kind of, you know, back end pieces. So I want to switch gears a little bit. I want to spend the last bit of time that we've got talking about something that I think very few people really understand or know about unless you've worked them from the inside. And that's something called an immediate advisement. And there's an entire process that CPI has in place by which the UPICs are mandated to make what is called an immediate advisement when a number of criteria are met. And, you know, over time, the immediate advisement criteria has changed. There is guidance on immediate advisements in the what's known as the PIM, the Program Integrity Manual. And I just looked this morning at the most recent version of 2020, and the list of changes and additions is unbelievable compared to what immediate advisements used to be. So, Matt, I want to go back to you, continue on this, you know, going around the horn, but talk a little bit about immediate advisements and how they've morphed over time and kind of the burden that immediate advisements have added to the workload.
Sure. Immediate advisements are those cases where that meet criteria that CMS believes that they need to be immediately informally referred to the OIG through a telephone call or an email to explain the facts of the case, separate and apart from MCC or any formal referral process. And the criteria for the longest time was very limited. It was a complaint from a present employee of the provider, kickbacks, fraud on behalf of a contractor employee, quality of care. If there's quality of care or patient abuse, those were cases that were had to be the OIG had to be immediately advised of. With any fact that had been gathered to that date, the UPICs, PSCs, ZPICs, they had 2 days to get it to the OIG informally through a phone call or whatever. And then the OIG had 30 to 45 days to say, yes, we want this, send all the information you have on it. And in the meantime, the contractor would sit back and not touch it. When MCC came about, immediate advisements were a discussion point because there weren't that many. And it was believed that the OIG was kind of not getting all the information or all the types of cases that they should. So they exponentially brought in more criteria for cases. If a medical review found 3 instances of services not rendered, that's grounds for an immediate advisement. 3 beneficiary interviews found that services were not rendered. Immediate advisement. There's probably another dozen or so criteria that were added that would be for this immediate advisement. And it was worked through the MCC process where the initial immediate advisement was made. The OIG would make their decision one way or the other. And then it would be brought back up at MCC again to have a formal decision made if the UPIC had found more evidence and things like that, or that other administrative action should be taken on the case. So the number of immediate advisements went up, and the burden on the UPICs was they had to go through all of their cases to make sure that none of them met those myriad of criteria now, to make sure that we were handling them appropriately according to the immediate advisement protocols.
So what's interesting is you talk about it as being an informal process, and I always remember getting something ultimately in writing. It would be like, you know, the medic would do an immediate advisement in a form, and you know, at some point it kind of went to that. But you know, the take home is that the list of criteria for what what ultimately became an immediate advisement grew so much that more things became immediate advisements than not. And so, you know, this gets back to the premise of like a vetting process, right? So the UPIC in an immediate advisement doesn't have any authority or leeway to make a determination about, hey, should we do this or should we not do this, right? You've got the criteria for an immediate advisement. You've got to make it. And, you know, it is what it is. So Wade, I want to go to you because, you know, I would, as an agent, we would get them just, you know, sent to us. And part of what was happening was if a UPIC investigator had a relationship with an agent, and if you had UPIC investigators that worked at the UPIC a long time, so, you know, where Matt was, that UPIC had morphed over my 20 plus year career. And there were a handful of people that were there that worked for Matt who had been there 20 years. And I knew them, right? So they're calling you directly. Hey, Eric, I've got this. And then there were other instances where they would just kind of send it. It would go to the duty agent. You would just kind of get it. And so when we talk about why cases can take so long is the UPIC's got to make this immediate advisement. You've got to get the information. You can't just sit on it or close it. You've got to take action on it quickly. So that's going to take some time. But so from your perspective, you know, and I would see more immediate advisements that could get no action versus those that could. But, you know, in LA, where you were just equally as busy, you know, how are immediate advisements handled? And, you know, did you guys have any internal criteria for determining if you were going to take a deeper dive into them?
Well, you know, my job was really all about, well, part of it was allocation of resources, and those could be time consuming. And at least in Los Angeles and Los Angeles region, I don't think it was rare that an immediate advisement led to an actual case that, you know, went through all the processes and got a conviction at the end. I mean, there were some, depending on the criteria, that we'd have to spend some time on to vet it out. And usually it was either, probably went to the duty agent to do that initial vetting, and then, you know, run it through the system to see if there's any hits related to other cases. If we could kind of absorb it into another case, that was probably our best case scenario, because then we were addressing it, but it wasn't a whole new set of hours being spent on the case. So that was one way we would do it. But another, like, I wouldn't call it rubber stamp, but everything kind of based off on, you know, you could say does, I mean, for a number of different reasons, but doesn't meet office guidelines. That was kind of what ended up with most of the immediate advisements. We'd have agents work with the UPIC investigators to, you know, see if we could get something out of it. But at the end of the day, when I had agents work in cases that were, you know, undercover operations and consensuals and doing recordings and all these things, it was, I had to dictate where those resources were going. And it's hard to pull someone off a case like that to vet out an immediate advisement. Sometimes I would send stuff to our, you know, within the Los Angeles region, we had offices in Las Vegas and Phoenix and, you know, different parts of the country where they frankly weren't as busy as we were in Los Angeles. So a lot of times, if I could somehow get that immediate advisement that needed a little bit of attention, I would get it to our other offices that maybe weren't as busy. But one of my friends in this whole thing was that doesn't meet office guidelines. So that could mean a bunch of things, but that was, again, I don't want to call it a rubber stamp, but that was used a lot.
Yeah, I mean, it's like anything else. It's resource allocation and the problems that exist in resource allocation. You can only fit so many things in the bag, right? You know, you can't fit 10 pounds of poop in the 5-pound bag. And if you're dealing with them, you know, I mean, I remember days where I would be the duty agent and I would get in a given week, you know, dozens of complaints that would come in through the OIG hotline, immediate advisements, and then just the UPIC investigator who calls you up and says, hey, I'm working on this. What do you think would make it an interesting case for you guys to take, right? Because it's part of those qualifications that the UPICs have are for referrals. So, but Matt brought up something, and I want to get Jason to give the final word on this. Matt brought up that one of the potential things for criteria for an immediate advisement are quality of care issues. And, you know, I was recently interviewed for A couple of things. I was involved with the ACFE fraud magazine, where we talked about Medicare Advantage fraud, but that kind of parlays into potentially some quality of care. And then I was recently on a podcast called The Whistleblower with a lawyer who's doing a bunch of hospice fraud cases. And I was just interviewed for a documentary that's going to be done on hospice fraud. But the prevailing theme in a lot of these conversations is fraud that's outside of the typical things, right? In the hospice world, we see a lot of it as kickbacks, signing people up for hospice who shouldn't be there. But, you know, there's always this prevailing discussion, and you see this a lot in the world of skilled nursing facilities and the like, is quality of care cases. And, you know, when I got hired, OIG didn't really work quality of care cases, because most of them were assaults on patients in nursing homes, terrible things, but things for which there was no federal statute. The closest thing I think that ever came up in any discussions regarding quality of care was this False Claims Act premise of worthless services, that the services they got in the care of the nursing home or the hospice were so poor that it amounted to a worthless service. But Jay, I want to turn it over to you as kind of the final thought, is just your take on this whole premise of quality of care and how either it should be addressed, like where is it lacking? And really, when you get quality of care cases in at a UPIC, and even when you were managing and supervising cases, like what are your thoughts on the whole premise of quality of care as an investigative area for the OIG?
Well, first, I do want to say that there was nothing more fun than to watch Eric as the duty agent, because it's like taking a hyper puppy and put it in a confined space. It was just it was almost sad in a way, but okay. So what you're referring to, and I think is a shout out to what ADVISE can do for SIUs and other agencies responsible for selecting the right cases, is we can help minimize your risk through prioritization. So it is unbelievable to me, as I'm involved in more and more engagements and looking at how to improve SIU process improvement, is there's a lot of attention that is needed to identifying those investigations that involve the most serious situations. So, you know, it's more complicated, and it's frankly a whole discussion is the prioritization of investigations, but quality of care is always going to be at the top. If you're an SIU, and having taken a couple of compliance introductions to different SIUs, it's very clear SIUs have the mindset that, you know, the health and welfare of their members is a prime concern. So not having a methodology in place to identify those qualities of care that have a substantial risk of being a true vulnerability, you know, just get thrown in the heap of other hundreds of investigations that just can't be gotten to immediately. So identifying things like that, starting with quality of care, is truly very important. One other quick shout out to an old person, as I just looked it up, and there are 94 federal judicial districts. So, woo! I mean, the long-term memory is still operating well. So thank you, Eric.
Well, so I'll say that it was close enough for government work, but I knew it was 94. I didn't want to correct you because, you know.
I just like his little off-the-shoulder T-shirt. It looks pretty good there.
Yeah, I didn't want to. It's like an episode. It's like watching Flashdance, the senior citizen version. Jason's wearing a stolen sweatshirt from the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center circa 1987. Clearly, we don't pay you well enough at ADVISE for you to buy yourself a new shirt, but we can have that conversation offline. But yeah, look, quality of care is a topic that I think will always be there, because I think that, you know, SIUs receive, and we'll call the UPICs and the Medic and SIU, because for all intents and purposes, it really is. And I think it's important to understand that the quality of care cases are always going to be there, right? Always, there's always going to be some issue with that. And it's just how you address it. And I, you know, I was asked, you know, what my thoughts were. I said, well, the first thing is that the federal government needs to come out with some legislation that either creates an environment to criminalize or tightens up something from a regulatory perspective under the False Claims Act for something like that. But you know, where Jason is making the point is from an SIU management perspective. And we're seeing this because we're doing this pretty frequently now, where we're coming in to these small and medium plans, and some now we're getting into some of the larger plans, and kind of helping them with retooling their already working systems. Because it's not a matter of dismantling, it's really just a matter of coming in and saying, where can some of these process improvements be made? Things like us helping with coordinating some criteria for creating an internal version of an MCC, particularly with larger plans in which you've got people working around the country. And we've actually talked about this on a previous podcast, but it's an important piece of the puzzle. If you're an SIU with hundreds of investigators across the country, you've got to be able to have coordination for these things, even smaller SIUs that cross states and regions. So the quality care thing is not going to go away. I think the challenge that the OIG has always had is when a quality of care case comes in as an immediate advisement, like, what do you do with it? You know, typically we would refer a quality of care allegation to the MFUCU, the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit, who actually had authority to do those investigations, because under state law, they had the ability to investigate things that included quality of care and were able to enforce state statutes. Whereas, you know, in very rare instances, were OIG agents in a position to be able to investigate and deal with the prosecution of what would be a state violation of law. You know, what a lot of people don't realize is, as an OIG agent, the mere fact that you have a badge and gun that says you're a federal law enforcement officer doesn't inherently give an OIG agent the authority to investigate a federal, state, or local crime. There's certain things that have to happen in order to allow that to take place. So, you know, I think that as we continue to develop our process improvement perspectives here, it helps us understand, obviously, a lot more about how the UPIC environment and the CMS mandates really do transcend into the SIU world. And things like the MCC and the immediate advisements are out there. And, you know, we always say that whether you like it or not, CMS is the gold standard. And, you know, why reinvent the wheel when you can kind of follow along what a lot of these things do? So, as always, guys, it's great to see you. I appreciate the time and the insights that all of you have. So, you know, we'll see you guys on the next episode. If you do not get our newsletter and you're looking to get our newsletter, which has the link to these podcasts that we do, you can send us an email at hello@advise.com. Also, catch us on LinkedIn. We've got our next LinkedIn Live coming up in February. Matt and I will be spending some time talking about one of my favorite fraud topics, podiatry fraud. We're going to talk about some of the latest schemes. We're going to talk about how the schemes of yesterday, a little bit of a retro fraud, are the schemes of today. So, as always, we appreciate everybody taking the time, and we'll see you on the next podcast.
Thank you all.
Thank you.